Heyman was going to be here, but he couldn't make it and asked me to be here in his stead, and I was pleased to do so. It's interesting. I guess it was in the late 60s that the Surgeon General at the time, I think his last name was Lewis, talked about us being at the end of the problems of infectious diseases. It was time to move on to other things. And it was just a matter of a few years after that that we started to see the kind of emergence of all kinds of problems which have continued to be a problem. And actually, even back in the 60s, as we all know, those of us who work in global health somewhat, that the problems of infectious diseases never left those developing countries and resource-poor settings. It's nice to see that infectious diseases is still being viewed as an important part of public health. I was sorry to see, though, I walked through the exhibit hall, and this gentleman, who actually I think started out in dentistry, who has a business called Infectious Awearables, and I have one of his ties right here. This is the influenza tie. He sells ties and scarves with infectious agents on them. He's not here this time, so that's too bad. Every year I try to get a new tie that covers some infectious disease. I taught for a number of years an introductory to microbiology and infectious disease course at the University of Vermont, and I always challenged my students. I said that you may not realize it, but virtually every day you'll find something about infectious diseases in the newspaper. Of course, I didn't realize then, but since then, students don't read newspapers anymore. If they do, it's online. But just to test my own assumption, I looked today in the USA Today, and sure enough, it was hard to find, but I did find something under the state reports that in Iowa, cases of whooping cough or pertussis have increased 33% in the state this year over last year. So there is virtually something every day in the paper about infectious diseases. Well, I have to tell you that I have nothing to disclose about my relationship with the CCDM and its production, and I have no financial interest to disclose. So David Heyman is the editor of this a very well-known and classic kind of infectious disease, communicable disease manual. It actually changed its name. In the early days, it was called Control of Communicable Diseases in Man, and that's been changed to Control of Communicable Diseases Manual. The history of this manual goes back to 1916, so it's actually the longest published volume by the American Public Health Association's Publications Board, approaching 100 years. It was actually first conceived by a local health officer in Newton, Massachusetts, Dr. Curtis, who felt it was important to have some compilation of this information about infectious diseases for others who were doing infectious disease control. It's been sold for the 100 years, or close to 100 years, with millions of copies. The list of editors and authors and reviewers are full of people from CDC and WHO and other areas who have expertise in the areas of infectious diseases. It's regularly updated, regularly meaning it's usually produced every 4 to 5 years in terms of its printed version. I'll talk in a moment about its online version and the plans for the future in terms of a more regular periodicity for updating. It's been defined as described by reviewers as a global resource, a classic. It's actually going to be going into its 20th edition, and the 20th edition will probably be coming out in about a year. A major change in what's happened. This is actually the volume right here. But a major change that's occurred within the last year is that the American Public Health Association partnered with Unbound Medicine to put the CCDM online. And I'll show you that today as part of the topic for it's the major focus of today's topic about having readily available information on the web. The other thing that's going to be exciting for me, and as was mentioned before, is we are going to create a companion document for this communicable disease manual, which relates specifically to the laboratory aspects of disease surveillance and infectious disease surveillance. Right now, I have to acknowledge that the way laboratory information in this volume is covered is somewhat inconsistent. And so since most of the chapters are written by people who may or may not have clinical microbiology or medical microbiology expertise, some chapters are excellent, some are not as well covered in terms of the laboratory aspects. So we're going to try to systematize that just as this is systematized relative to the epidemiology and outbreak control information. And we want to look at things like laboratory-based reporting, which is actually incredibly important in communicable disease control. Studies that have shown that in areas where infectious diseases are reported and counted and tabulated, laboratory-based surveillance has actually been better in terms of its reliability, its accuracy, and completeness. So, not that it displaces clinical-based reporting reporting based on diagnoses, other than clinical diagnoses, but it really is an important part of the picture. So we're going to try to emphasize that. We're also going to try to bring in the issues, the questions around case laboratory-based case definitions. So the CDC right now has a set of case definitions which they put together on an annual basis with the Council of State and Territory Epidemiologists, which not only defines what is a clinical case definition, but also what is a laboratory-based, laboratory-confirmed case definition. And I would submit that there needs to be some more input and integration of laboratorians into that process. So we're going to talk about that issue in this new volume. We're also going to talk about some of the real challenges that the users of laboratory information have relative to understanding the sensitivity, specificity of laboratory tests and the limitations of some tests. We're going to talk about some of the safety issues, which people need to understand. What has happened in the last 5 years is that on the international level, at the same time that the international health regulations were kind of revised, there was a resolution passed through the International Health Assembly that said that every country, 193 countries that signed on to this, will have by 2015 basic laboratory and epidemiology capacity. Doesn't necessarily mean they're going to have the capacity to do laboratory assays at the highest level, but they at least need to have the capacity to know what they can and what they can't do, and know what they have to do in terms of referring specimens and referring information out. So we're hoping that this manual and this compendium, this companion to the manual that deals with laboratory issues will deal with that as well. So give laboratories the opportunity to see how they can best integrate themselves into these laboratory-based referral networks. So that's an exciting component, and it's an exciting development from my perspective. It should come out consistent with the and concurrently with the 20th edition of CCDM. Another thing about this manual, rather, which has been very exciting, has been its translation into multiple languages. And so originally it was strictly in English, but of late it's become available now in 8 different languages in addition to English. And even the online version has been translated into French, which has been very useful. It covers about 500 diseases, including all those reportable diseases which are now under the international health regulations, all the CDC notifiable diseases, the neglected tropical diseases, and virtually all communicable diseases you might be aware of. So the translation partnership has been one that we've had, we, APHA, with WHO and PAHO. And the languages in which CCDM is now available in print form includes Arabic, Chinese, French, Italian, Japanese, Mongolian, Russian, and Spanish, in addition to the English version. So how is this classic used in terms of a manual for communicable disease control? Well, as was mentioned in my introduction, I spent about 25 years in public health settings with public health laboratories, but always working in concert with epidemiologists. And I know that the infectious disease epidemiologists I've worked with have kind of used this as their constant companion. There are other resources, of course, but this seems always in their library of references to keep with them at the ready. More and more people who don't necessarily have epidemiology background also are involved in outbreak response and are responsible for communicable disease control, those individuals also benefit from having this kind of a manual at hand. The whole area of risk assessment and management is becoming more and more of an issue relative to communicable diseases and how we deal with that. And so this manual deals with and provides information along those lines. Risk communication. I think about examples of this that I've been involved with. I know that when we had the anthrax scares of the 2001, there were a lot of concerns on the part of the public about what this means and what the data means and what the findings mean, and even negative findings. And the same holds true. I know that in Vermont we've had annually a wild animal rabies vaccine program, and realizing that the public knew that this was caused, or this actually, this vaccine included vaccinia, live vaccinia virus, there was some concern, and just being able to communicate that those issues and provide some information to the public, which is understandable and helpful, also is covered to some extent in the manual. This whole area of response to deliberate use of biological agents is a whole new area, and one of the general chapters that David Heyman added to the manual in the last edition was one that specifically dealt with what we do with biothreat agents. Infection control, of course, and then vaccination strategies. It really deals a lot with what we need to do to really deal with some of the problems, like pertussis, as I mentioned in today's paper, vaccine-preventable diseases, some of which actually are not really under control as they should be. And as we know, there's a certain movement in the U.S. and elsewhere about kind of an anti-vaccination strategy. This kind of thing puts things into perspectives and gives the readers some vaccination information. So how is this set up? Well, if you look at the way the chapters, it actually has 10 general chapters, and then it has 136 disease or syndrome-specific chapters. And each of those disease-specific chapters include these sections. So the actual disease name, and there have been changes there. We were talking this morning about how just in the taxonomy of microbes, that changes a lot. Also, the disease classification, the actual name that we're using for diseases, changes from time to time. I understand that we actually are not, we're migrating away from AIDS to HIV infection stage 3, I think it's now being officially called. Leprosy and Hansen's disease. So disease names are changing, and this not only puts down what is the current accepted terminology, but also symptoms or rather synonyms that may be seen or used in the literature. Identification of the disease, clinical feature of the disease that's covered, differentiation from other kinds of diseases that might be confused with the disease in question. The infectious agent is covered here. Part of that information will probably migrate into the laboratory companion, but we'll see how that goes. The occurrence of the disease and where it occurs and who it affects and who's at risk, that's covered. The reservoir of the disease or the agent that causes the disease, is it human, is it non-human, is it environmental, where does it reproduce, those things are covered. Mode of transmission, how is it spread, and how is it, particularly how is it spread among two humans and among humans, if indeed it is spread among humans. Not all infectious diseases, obviously, are communicable. Incubation time, so that period between the exposure and the symptoms, the appearance of symptoms is covered here. The period of communicability, how this is something that actually the public oftentimes doesn't understand, that people can be very infectious even without showing symptoms, either before symptoms present, or they may be asymptomatic and still be infectious. Susceptibility, what are the, and who are the populations at risk? So this is the kind of standard outline of how the disease-specific chapters are set up. Then it moves into the areas of control. Preventive measures, both for individuals and for large populations. What are the steps you need to take to prevent the spread of this disease? Control of patients, the contacts, environment, is isolation appropriate? What are the kind of standard precautions, are standard precautions appropriate or necessary? In most cases, obviously, yes. Epidemic measures. is the disease one that actually lends itself to possible spread in a wide way, and what needs to be done in order to prevent that? Disaster implications, really kind of outlining what would happen if indeed the disease is not contained, that's covered. International measures. And this is something where the SARS epidemic kind of points out that we need to have a commitment to good exchange of information on an international level. So what is required? What are the international health regulations in terms of requiring reporting? What needs to be done in order to prevent spread across international borders? And then deliberate use measures. This gets back to the point of if this is in fact an agent that might be subject to use by those who want to provide a threat through biological agents, that's covered as well. I wanted to talk about some of the ways in which the manual has been used, and one of the examples that was given to me by the APHA publication staff was they said that after the earthquake in Haiti in January of this year, there was actually a request to APHA for a number of these manuals or specific parts of the manuals. And so the way in which this was handled actually is that there were copies of the online version that were made available both to CDC and to others in Prevention Haiti through the Merieux Foundation in France, which actually took on the responsibility and the task of translating and putting it available, making it available in the online version to Haiti at no cost to the people in Haiti. So through this global link for online biomedical expertise, this was made available to them. So that was very helpful. And now I think just with the recent hurricane, maybe some of the same needs have reoccurred in Haiti. Some of the diseases that they were interested in, the disease-specific chapters, included things like anthrax and cholera. As we were talking as a group the other day, cholera was not necessarily a problem in Haiti. It may have been introduced actually by workers from outside of the country, and most likely was brought in. That's a problem, obviously, but it still it creates an issue of cholera spread that needs to be dealt with. Foodborne disease is a huge problem. Waterborne could have been included as well. Malaria, meningitis, pneumonia, tetanus, all of those diseases are were of importance and were of concern, and those chapters from the manual were shared. So I wanted to move on to the online version a little bit and show you about that, since that's the main focus of our panel and our discussion today, this session. So as I said, this is a partnership between the American Public Health Association, the publisher of CCDM. Actually, WHO is a co-publisher or sponsor of this as well. But this partnership exists for the online version with a group called Unbound Medicine. So this just was made available in this year, in 2010, and the response has been very positive and very promising. What the Unbound Medicine version of CCDM does is it allows people to not only search the manual, so they can use it as a search engine, and I'll demonstrate that in a moment. You can put in specific words and search the manual and find information readily. And you can actually do this on your computer. You also can download the CCDM onto your PDA. So if you have an iPhone or BlackBerry, you can actually bring the information into that format. But you also can use it as a gateway to other information. So there's a link between Unbound Medicine then and Medline. So you can do Medline searches via this mechanism. You also can get public health news feeds that come out of WHO or APHA and others. And you can use it to archive your searches, which is very helpful. So as you do this, you can create your own kind of archived setup for the diseases that you're mostly interested in. So what I wanted to do now was just take some scenarios that I've kind of just selected to demonstrate how CCDM manual online particularly could be used. And the first one that I wanted to talk about was dengue. And the reason I brought this up is because in one of my public health roles, I was working in the state of Michigan. This was back in the 80s. And there, and part of my activities there at the Department of Health were to participate in infectious disease symposia all the time at the university, or Michigan State University. But there was a case there that was presented that actually I think the clinicians involved could have benefited from having CCDM and using it and looking at that case. It was an individual who was a university professor at Michigan State who had contracted this febrile disease. And I was trying to recall the time of the year. It seems to me it was a time of the year when you wouldn't normally think about mosquitoes existing in Michigan. But it was a febrile disease with severe muscle and joint aches. And so they were kind of perplexed as to what this might be. And of course, the telling, I think, information that they collected was that the person had recently been to Puerto Rico at a professional meeting, and she recalled having been out on her balcony and being exposed to mosquito bites quite a bit during the week that she was there. So if one goes into the CCDM then and looks at just putting into the search field fever, you actually come up with this list, and it's much longer than this, but this is just the first screenshot of all the febrile diseases that you might see in the Communicable Disease Manual. And then if you further type in fever and myalgia, then you come up with another list, which is reflected here. And then finally, if you add in the area of mosquitoes, or the word mosquitoes, you end up with dengue fever. One of the things that kind of threw the clinicians in this was the laboratory testing. So they did some laboratory testing, and they were thinking about an arbovirus, and they tested the woman actually for St. Louis encephalitis, and there was at the time some cross reactivity between the results of the serology that suggested maybe she had St. Louis encephalitis, and she actually had a microbiology background, and she I think was the one who kind of self-diagnosed as being dengue fever. So when the further testing was done, which wasn't available in Michigan, to really confirm that she had dengue fever, that ultimately proved to be the case. So if one were to use the CCDM, then, as I just demonstrated, and search for a disease which you don't necessarily know what the diagnosis is, it can help you lead, you know, to the point of the diagnosis. And then you can talk about or look at some of the things we just discussed in the way the manual's set up. So here we talk about the identification of dengue fever and the presentation the clinical presentation of dengue fever. You can bring up this screen, which actually outlines then the entire chapter of CCDM, and you can go specifically and click on what portion of it you want to. So if you wanted to click on a portion that dealt with the laboratory aspects, you could come to this kind of section where it talks about what can be done and what should be done in order to confirm a disease a diagnosis as dengue fever. One can also then go on to the part on control and determine what is it you need to do to control the case, what indeed do you need to do to treat the case, although CCM, I think, clearly states that it's not intended to be a replacement for any therapeutic manuals, but it does touch on treatment. So this also shows us here that on this, as the arrows show us, we can then archive or we can search further. So if we wanted to look at this and look at dengue fever, we could search for different articles on dengue fever. We could archive what we were working on. This shows us in the upper right-hand corner here the ability to search on Medline. In this case, the individual is looking at a variety of different journal articles, and you can bring those articles up through the Unbound Medicine link with Medline. You have an abstract of that article, bring it into your archived workup of dengue fever. So a lot of features that Unbound Medicine provides to the user that the printed manual does not give us. So let me then talk also about using this for diseases that might have been of interest with the Haiti post-earthquake problems, diarrheal diseases and malaria, for example. Now, it may be that it's not a problem of really identifying what the disease is, but it's really, you know what the disease is, but you need to have up-to-date information on what you need to do to control that disease. In both these cases, one, I'm suggesting that there's an outbreak of diarrheal disease, and if you put in diarrhea as your search word, this is the first thing that comes up. If you put in diarrhea and children, if that's where the focus of the problem is, then you start to see a shrinking of the diseases that might be of consideration. And then if you have some evidence that you're working with a specific cause, like E. coli, you can put E. coli into the search window as well, and you'll come up with a shorter list of diseases and disease-specific chapter information like this. So just for the sake of argument, I'm going to say that we're talking about enteropathogenic strains of E. coli. And so as you reach that point, again, we come with the information about what are the clinical symptoms that are associated with enteropathogenic E. coli-caused diarrhea. That's covered in this identification section. What are some of the preventive measures that are necessary to prevent the further transmission of this type of diarrhea? That's covered here. If you want to talk about control of the patient contacts and also specific treatment, also this is covered in this part of the manual. So again, one can use the manual to help guide you towards the diagnostic aspects of disease control, but also then follow up with control measures, prevention measures, and actually even treatment measures. If you know that you're dealing with a disease like malaria, then you can start with that and go straight to the malaria chapter and then start to look at what are some of the issues that you need to be concerned about. And I think about an outbreak like, say, malaria in a developing country, where sometimes the people who are coming into the area are medical experts, but not necessarily ones that have seen or worked with a disease like malaria. So that's also a place where this is very helpful for the health care practitioners who are helping in these resource-constrained areas, who they themselves have not necessarily had the experience with the disease. So the CCDM can help them in that regard. Here we see malaria and the coverage of the identification of malaria, the clinical symptoms of malaria, what some of the various, obviously, causative agents of malaria are, how they differ, what the means of control of malaria are, methods of control, including here we zero in on some indoor residual spraying of insecticides as a means of control, which has to be carried out in specific ways so you don't create other problems. But you can also link in here, you see a hot link to WHO methods and standards relative to malaria control. Another example we could use here is just a cholera outbreak, whether or not it's in Haiti or wherever it is. There are a variety of different agents that can cause cholera, different serotypes, and this goes into the various serotypes of Vibrio cholerae. Talks about the modes of transmission of cholera, again, usually a waterborne disease. Talks about the identification, the clinical symptoms of the disease, and again, draws you into the specific treatment that is necessary for individuals who contract cholera. Much of course, we know is going to be related to not just maintaining somebody's electrolyte balance and dealing with the dehydration problems. And then I'll finish up with pertussis. And again, I come back to my experience, not so much in my experience in Michigan and California, but my more recent experience in Vermont. And that is with the disease pertussis. And so pertussis is one of those diseases, vaccine-preventable diseases, which actually has been seen in the increase. And part of the problem is that pertussis was thought of as whooping cough and thought of as affecting young children. But I think the realization that actually could occur in adolescents and young adults in a different presentation took a while to really catch on. And there was a need to actually kind of prove that that was possible, to see that some of this chronic bronchitis that was occurring and ways in which pertussis was being spread from individuals with that presentation to children was occurring. And so the CCDM kind of goes into that in terms of how pertussis presents not only in young children, but also in individuals who are adolescents or young adults. It also, I think, resulted in this whole need to revaccinate people for pertussis. And as we know, pertussis, the vaccine for pertussis has been a problem because of some of the side effects. So now we have the acellular vaccine. So that's mentioned as well here. Preventive measures, basically the major preventive measure for pertussis is to try to vaccinate the susceptible population, and that's covered here in the CCDM. So I mentioned that also the CCDM Unbound Medicine version allows us to tap into public health news. So here we see we can tap into WHO articles, which cover a variety of different topics. So the Unbound Medicine version of CCDM can act as, again, not only a search engine for specific disease containment, control, treatment, prevention strategies, but also as a gateway for other information. So I wanted to wrap up with just sharing with you that individuals who have an interest in trying this, looking at this, there is a the APHA has made available this month free use access to the Unbound Medicine version of CCDM. So I've got some cards which I'll leave up here, and then people can take those and try it at their leisure. I'm actually about to wrap up, so I think if there are any questions right now, I can take them quickly, but we're going to hold most of the questions for the panel. Yes?
One question on that search feature, is that only online?
On the iPhone, you should be able to use it on search on the. You should be able to. Mm-hmm. You may have to obviously expand it up so you can see it. Okay, but it should be there. Yeah. Yes, sir.
Yeah, just wanted to put up in a portal for physicians to communicate in terms of treating a disease. Mm-hmm. Can you just link this site
to the link to Unbound Medicine? One can get into this through Unbound Medicine. And there are other Unbound Medicine products. This doesn't necessarily get you into those products. So it does get you into some things like the Medline search, but it doesn't necessarily get you into other Unbound Medicine services. They're both now actually, APHA is looking at that. They now actually are both sold separately. So. Thank you very much.